Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 46. I'm going to do verses 1 through 34. I'm going to entitle this section, Joseph Brings His Family to Egypt. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 45, we saw Joseph providing for his family by sending cartloads of grain and such back to his father Jacob in Hebron, where he probably is, after Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. So we start now in Genesis 46, verse 1. So Israel, that's Jacob, set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. He set out probably from his family estate at Hebron, as the NIV Study Bible says. It never says that he's at Hebron, but I've been assuming that, and the NIV Study Bible assumes it, and that's reasonable. The last mention we have of where Jacob was in Genesis 35, verse 27. Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre of Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. That's right, when Isaac and Esau had gotten together to bury their father Isaac at Hebron, that's the last we have contact of where, or the last place we have knowledge of where Jacob was. So we assume that's where he was. If you look at the map, there's a road that runs south and southwest from Hebron right down to Beersheba. Beersheba's on the direct route to Egypt, so it makes sense that they came to Beersheba. Now, Beersheba's a famous place for the patriarchs. Abraham and Isaac had both worshipped God there. In Genesis 21:33, we see Abraham planting a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, or an oak tree, some translations have it. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. Now there in chapter 21, Abraham is making an oath, making a covenant with Abimelech of Gerar there, that little town right to the northwest of Beersheba, that little kink, not town, but that little kingdom. If you recall, Abraham gave Abimelech 7 ewe lambs, and so therefore Beersheba is called Well of the Oath. Beer is well. They made a well there. And so the name of the well was Well of the Oath because the covenant was made there, or it could be the Well of Seven because Abraham gave 7 ewe lambs there, and they're not sure how to translate Beersheba. So Abraham worshipped at Beersheba. And Isaac, that was Jacob's grandfather, Abraham, and Jacob's father, Isaac, worshipped there. Genesis 26, 23 through 25. Then he, referring to Isaac, went up from there. That's Gerar, same place that Abraham left, and went to Beersheba, just like his father Abraham. Then the Lord appeared to Isaac the same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord. So we've got a very holy place where Abraham and Isaac had both called on the name of the Lord there, made covenants there with their neighbors. So Jameson Fawcett Brown says, because of this historical reason, Jacob deliberately chose Beersheba to stop and worship God. Not to mention that it's right on the way, as I said earlier. Now, Beersheba's an interesting place. I've been there, actually, on a tour to Israel with my wife. And David Ben-Gurion, the first president of Israel, thought that the southern part of Israel would be the place that the Jews trying to start their nation should focus on because there were less Arabs to fight them down there. And he has his house there, and you can go see his house. It's a neat place. And the scenery is beautiful. So now let me read you some facts about Beersheba from Easton's. Now, Easton's was written before David Ben-Gurion, so Easton's is not going to mention what I just told you, but it will give some other interesting facts about the city. It was a favorite place of abode of both Abraham and Isaac, if I just sort of said that. It was given as one of the cities given to the tribe of Simeon. It was included in that famous shorthand way of referring to Israel from Dan to Beersheba, Dan way up in the north to Beersheba way down in the south, a distance of about 144 miles. That phrase Dan to Beersheba came to be a proverb, actually. And the rest of the stuff is not really all that interesting. We go now to Genesis 46, verses 2 and 3. God spoke to Israel, that's Jacob, in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he, Jacob, said, Here I am. God said, he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. So this is a repeat of the offspring promised to Abraham. It was repeated to Abraham's son Isaac and Jacob's father Isaac, and now it's been repeated to Jacob. The promise of a great nation, offspring, that great nation is the same thing as saying a seed, an offspring, That was one of the three promises to Abraham, land, offspring, and blessing. Genesis 26:24, the Lord appeared to Isaac the same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham, do not fear. I am with you, I will bless you, and I will multiply your descendants. Another, which is the same way of saying, I will make you a great nation there. That was in the midst of Isaac's dealings with the aforesaid Abimelech of Gerar. And so God repeats the promise of offspring to Jacob. Very, very promise. Very, very prominent promise in the book of Genesis. Now, it was a vision of the night. Now, a vision usually means you're awake when you see it, but when you say it at night, it sounds like you're asleep. I don't worry about the differences between visions and dreams too much. The point is they came from God. Now, God speaks that way usually only at critical points in an individual's life. And in fact, I can't think of a single vision in the Old Testament or New Testament that didn't come at a critical point in that individual's life or a critical point in the history of the history of redemption. I'll give you some examples. Abraham's asked to sacrifice Isaac. God gave Abraham a vision. When Paul was on the road to Damascus about to kill Christians in Syria or arrest them, Jesus gave Paul a vision. When Paul was in the Antonia fortress at the end of Acts, when the Jews had a mob there trying to kill him, and the Roman soldier there, whose name slips my mind, the Roman soldier there arrested Paul in order to protect him. So Paul's lying in jail there in a very bad way. God gave him a vision and said, be true to the heavenly vision. How about when Paul was on the second journey, I believe it was, he was in Troas in Asia, and right across the Hellespont there would have been Europe. Should he go there? Should he double back and go back to Asia? Should he go over to Europe? He had a vision, the Macedonian call. So God gives visions at critical points in individuals' lives. Visions don't happen every day, and I suspect that the Old Testament people were just as excited as you and I would be if we had a vision today. I never have had one. I've heard of people who've had them. Of course, I'm a little bit skeptical of these things because so many people have visions of all kinds of stuff that's nonsense. But nonetheless, a vision would be an exciting thing, and it was something that Jacob needed. Why was this a critical juncture in his life? Well, because he was an old man, had to go across the desert. In fact, in the vision, God said, Jacob, don't be afraid. Why might Jacob be afraid? Well, Jacob was old. He's traveling through the desert. He might be tempted in an idolatrous land. Boy, I'm telling you, Egypt had idols everywhere. Jacob might forget the promised land when he goes down there. He gets prosperous. And Jacob might remember the prohibition that God had given to his father Isaac, Genesis 26:1-2. Now, there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar, to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. The Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. And now Abraham might be thinking, well, God, you told Isaac not to go down there. My father Isaac, why are you telling me to go down there? Well, the times have changed. Different dream, different vision, different message. But it's understandable that Jacob might have been a little reluctant. Also, there was a prophecy given to Abraham, which was, I'm sure, known to Jacob, as all these visions would have been known, all these prophecies would have been known to the patriarchs, Genesis 15:13, prophecy that Abraham and his seed would be slaves to the Egyptian, or Abraham's seed would be slaves to the Egyptian. Egyptians, Genesis 15:13, God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. So Isaac's going to know that. He's going to think, well, I don't want to go down to Egypt. I don't want to be oppressed. Not only that, he had reason not to trust his sons. I mean, his sons have been lying to him forever. His sons had sold his son Joseph into slavery. Now, we don't know whether the sons ever confessed up to that, but I figured that he had to have. How else are the sons going to explain to their father that Joseph ended up being the number two man in Egypt? There's only one way to explain that. He wasn't torn up by the wild beast in his coat of many colors. We sold him to Egypt. And so Jacob might think, you know, I don't know if I trust these guys, my sons. Maybe they haven't told me everything. Maybe they told me the good news of Joseph and what Joseph said, but maybe there's something they're not telling me. Well, let's speculate on this a little bit. Did Jacob still not have reason to trust the kids? I think the sons have been pretty convincing. They sound like they're totally penitent now as they talk. They never did apologize that we know of for selling Joseph into slavery. However, they seem like they were talking in earnest when they talked about what Joseph had said. So, and besides, what's Jacob got to lose? You hear that his son's alive? Go down there and check it out. Of course he's going to do. That's going to overcome all of his objections. Plus the visions that don't be afraid. But anyway, I'm giving you a list of what might make Jacob afraid. The last thing that might make Jacob afraid is if he carries all his descendants down there, the promised line of the descendants might die out. The famous seed of Abraham's promises, land, offspring, and blessing. You're leaving the land and you're taking all the seed with you, all the offspring with you. How are they going to be a blessing to the nations when they all die? But God says, don't worry, Jacob. I will make you a great nation there. And a great nation, that's just another way of saying I'm going to give you lots of offspring. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, this is a reaffirmation of God's covenant promise, the promise of the offspring, that part of the promise, not the land, but the offspring promise. As the NIV Study Bible, God reaffirmed one aspect of his promise to Abraham. Now, of course, the first promise to Abraham was made in Genesis 12:2, as Abraham was departing from Haran to go to the promised land. God tells Abraham, or Abram as he was called at the time, and I will make you a great nation. There's that phrase again, a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so shall you be a blessing. Now, did this promise that God made to Jacob here, did it come to pass? God's promises always come to pass. Jacob went down there with 70 people, and at the Exodus, when they came out with 600,000 people. That's a huge increase. In fact, that's why the Egyptians got upset and worried, because the Jews were increasing so much up there in the land of Goshen. They said, oh my gosh, man, maybe we better get rid of these people. How do we know six? Well, I tell you what, let's look at the scriptures that show that the Israelites went from 70 to 600,000 people. Genesis 46, verse 27, which we'll get to in a minute. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were two. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. So there's 70 people that came with Jacob. And we need to look at that number 70 more precisely in a minute, but just for right now, it's 70. And then we look in Exodus, at the Exodus, Exodus 1, verses 5 through 7. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph died. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and greatly increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Well, there's your multiplication. The exact number is given in Exodus 12:37. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramesses, that's in Goshen, to Succoth, which is closer to Israel, right around the Suez area, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. So there's your numbers. That promise was made. Now let's pick up a few incidental details here. God spoke to Israel, to Jacob, in visions of the night, and said, Jacob, Jacob. And what did Jacob say? Here I am. Well, that phrase, here I am, it sounds familiar. I think Samuel said it. I don't have my notes in my notes that he said it, but my memory tells me he said it. We also know that Abraham said it when God tested Abraham and said, you need to put your only son Isaac, who is your seed that's going to be fulfill the covenant promise of the seed. I want you to take him and put him up on an altar on Mount Moriah. So in Genesis 22:1, we read this. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he, Abraham, said, here I am. When God calls you and you say, here I am, that means you're going to do what he says. And even though the things that he asked you to do were pretty rough, pretty hard. I mean, putting your only son up on an altar, go through the desert when I'm 130 years old, down to a pagan land, leaving the promised land with a bunch of sons that I don't trust further than I can spit. Here I am. I'll do what you say, God. Boy, I tell you, if anybody thinks that the Christian life is a bed of roses and you don't have to make hard, hard decisions when you're a Christian, that person doesn't know the faith. God, when he speaks to Jacob and tells him to go to Egypt, God says, I am God, the God of your father, God of Isaac. So he always appeals to the ancestors, God of Abraham, God of the father, the fathers, the patriarchs. Patriarchs, that word, the feminists love to hate. We go now to Genesis 46:4. God continues in his vision, his night vision with Jacob. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. Now, the problem is that Jacob died in Egypt, and so God didn't bring him back up again. So what did God mean? Well, it meant it was one of two things. One, it could be that God meant that his corpse would be carried back to Machpelah at the Oak of Mamre in Hebron and buried there, which it was, same place where he'd buried Isaac at Hebron. Or when God said, I will surely bring you up again, he's referring to Jacob's posterity that would come back during and after the Exodus. I tend to think he's talking about his corpse. I will bring you up again so you'll be buried in the land of the promise. They were very big back then on where people were buried. And that idea is still with us kind of today. These movie stars, you know, they divorce four times, so they got all these options as to who they're going to be buried next to. And so they pick out their favorite deceased spouse and say, I want to be buried next to that one. It means a lot to people, especially people who aren't believers. But at any rate, God tells Jacob, Joseph, your son, Joseph will close your eyes. Why did God tell him that? Well, that's to assure Jacob that Joseph was actually alive. Joseph can't close Jacob's eyes unless Joseph is actually alive. So go on down to Egypt. Joseph is going to close your eyes. He's still down there. Your brothers aren't lying to you. Not only is he down there, he's going to outlive you. We go now to Genesis 46, 5 through 7. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, where he was, as we just said. Beersheba, by the way, is, if you look at the Dead Sea and go about a third of the way up, right there at the crook at the little land bridge, which is now actually covered over with sand, but it used to be a little narrow piece of water there, about a third of the way up of the Dead Sea. And then you, as you're going from south to north, and then you go west toward the Mediterranean Sea, about halfway to the Mediterranean, there's Beersheba. And it's on the main route to Egypt, as I said. So Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives and the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their property, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now, Jacob is leaving for Egypt here, and there's no mention of Jacob's wives. Well, that's probably because they're all dead now. We know Rachel was definitely dead, Genesis 35:19. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. That was on the way back from Haran. Well, that was after they had stayed in Shechem for a while, after they had come back from Haran. And then Jacob was on his way south, going from Shechem on his way to Bethlehem. And he did make it somewhere right outside. I forgot the name of the little place right outside of Bethlehem. Rachel died. So she's gone. Leah was probably dead. We don't know for sure, but Gil speculates that she was probably dead. He refers to Genesis 49:31. There, that's Hebron, they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah. This is Jacob talking about burying Leah. Well, if he buried Leah, he probably did it in Hebron before he came down to Egypt. So she's probably gone. And Bilhah and Zilpah, Jacob's two concubines, they're probably dead by now since no notice is taken of them. So we're looking at a lonely widower heading out to see his beloved son Joseph. Now they put all their stuff in wagons that the Pharaoh had sent. That's in a previous verse, which unfortunately I didn't write in my notes, but if you recall, Pharaoh said, Joseph, take these wagons up there so they'll have something to come back in, and Joseph did it. John Gill asks, well, why didn't Joseph send his chariot for Jacob? Why did Joseph expect Jacob to ride in a wagon? Why not send a chariot? Well, chariot's probably not fit for a long ride across the desert. These wagons were made for the long haul. Jacob and his family took their livestock and their property. Now, that means they seem to have ignored Pharaoh's admonition in Genesis 45:20. The Pharaoh had told the brothers, do not concern yourselves with your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. In other words, don't worry about losing your goods. Just leave them behind. You come on down to Egypt. Well, they didn't do that. They took their stuff with them and their livestock. And I would have done the same thing, too. All their property which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, that would be the sons had acquired that in the land of Canaan, but of course Jacob had acquired a bunch of stuff up in Syria, in Padan Aram in Syria, and so this verse is only talking about what the sons brought from Canaan, not everything. John Gill points that little detail out. Verse 7, it says that Jacob's daughters and his granddaughters came. They're not listed in the genealogy, well, not all of them. A couple, I think Dinah was listed, but most of them are not. And the daughters might have included daughters-in-law, as Adam Clark said. Dinah was his only daughter, so he might have had, when it says daughters plural, that probably refers to his daughters-in-law. Of course, it could be a female descendant. There's one named Sarah in his genealogy, which we're getting ready to look at. So maybe it included that, but basically it's the men that came down that are mentioned in the genealogies, but also unmentioned in the genealogies, for the most part, are also daughters and granddaughters. So when we think about 70 going down to Egypt, it's really 70, which is not including some of the women, some of the female granddaughters or daughters that we don't know anything about. Now, Jacob, he's getting ready to go. I said he was old. He's actually 130 years old now. I don't have the site that tells us that. I've seen it. We've already passed it. Adam Clark says this is 215 years before the promise, or after the promise was made to Abraham of the land, offspring, and blessing. So now we go to a genealogy of the people who went down to Egypt. Logical place to put it. Now, I know genealogies can be tedious. But I'm going to pick out some stuff through this one. I'm not going to read it to you because it would bore you to tears. First thing we need to note of this, I'm going to call this the Genesis 46 genealogy, just for shorthand. This Genesis 46 genealogy is repeated verbatim in Exodus 1:1, which is kind of interesting. In verse 11, three sons of Levi are mentioned, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. That might not seem very interesting, but actually, when you get to the book of Leviticus, those were the three main families of Levi, and each one of those families had a responsibility in carrying a certain part of the tabernacle through the wilderness. So they are very prominent. They show up later in our studies when we get there. Ur is mentioned in verse 11. That was Judah's son who married Tamar. God killed Ur because he was evil. Remember that story. It was a whole chapter devoted to the story of Judah and Tamar. To briefly recap, Tamar married Ur. Ur was evil. God killed him. Next son up, according to the Levirate practice, was Onan. Tamar married Onan, but Onan would not get Tamar pregnant because he spilled his seed on the ground because he was a lazy bum who would not carry out his Levirate duties. So Tamar is bereaved twice. Judah apparently thinks she's a jinx or something. He says, why don't you go live with your father? And when my third son, whose name was Shelah, when he grows up, you can marry her. Well, that didn't happen. So Tamar came up with this great idea, pretending she was a prostitute. She seduced her father-in-law, Judah, and she got pregnant by her father-in-law. Pretty disgusting, but that's in the Bible. Another couple of people mentioned in this genealogy, Perez and Zerah, they're famous because those are the two sons of Tamar that her father-in-law, Judah, fathered in her when she pretended to be a prostitute. And they're directly in the lines of Messiah, too. Now, in verse 15, the genealogy talks about these are the sons. Let's see, who is that? The sons of Leah. And all through the genealogy, it talks about sons. It's talking about sons and descendants, including grandsons. That's the way genealogies work. Now, there are summaries, partial subtotals as you go through. In verse 15, it says there are 33. These are the 33 sons of Leah. Now, there's a problem here because if you count the names between verses 8 and 15, Leah's descendants, according to the NIV Study Bible, there are 34 names. I did count them, and yes, there are 34, but the scripture says in verse 15 there's 33. How do you handle that? NIV Study Bible says there's a name, Ohad, in verse 10 that should be removed from the list because Ohad doesn't appear in parallel list in Numbers 26, 12 through 13, and 1 Chronicles 4, 24. And the Hebrew for Ohad looks very much like the nearby Zohar, which is in the same verse, and a later scribe probably added Ohad to the text accidentally. In other words, it's a textual problem. That makes a lot of sense. So we got 33 kids, sons of Leah. Well, sons and daughters, actually, because Dinah's in there. Now, as I say, there were subtotals. Let's see how the subtotals work. Leah's sons and daughters in verse 33 are said to be 33 in verse 15. Then we add Zilpah's sons and daughters. They're 16. That's in verse 18. There's 16 of those. So 33 plus 16 is 49. And then Rachel had sons, 14 of them, 2 by Joseph and 12 by Benjamin. That's in verse 22. So that we add 14 to our subtotal of 49, and we come up with 63. And then Bilhah's sons, she had 7 sons in verse 25. So you take 63, add 7 to it, and you got 70. So let's remember the Genesis 46 genealogy has 70 descendants in it. Now we go to Genesis 46, 26 through 27. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all. Well, now right there, you see a problem. 66, well, I just said they were 70. So we've got to look at that in just a minute. Verse 27, and the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2, that's Ephraim and Manasseh. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. So in verse 26, it's 66, and in verse 27, it's 70. Now, first of all, Moses was no dummy. He's not going to write two verses back to back with contradictory numbers in them unless he has a reason for it. So, but before we get into that contradiction, that alleged contradiction, let's look at a minor detail here. In verse 26, the genealogy says, not including the wives of Jacob's sons. I just mentioned that earlier. I'll mention it again here. It explicitly states it. It's not including the women. You scan that Genesis 46 genealogy, and you'll see that. The wives are not there. Now let's go back to the 70 and 66 difference. How do we reconcile that? Well, the easiest way, I'm going to tell you this, it's a real easy way, and I like easy. So we're going to go with this way. The other way I can't make work, but I looked at the commentators. There's two ways of doing it. Here's the easy way. You take 70 in the Genesis 46 genealogy, and then you subtract Ur and Onan out. That's the sons of Judah, because Ur and Onan were dead. They didn't go to Egypt. They were dead. That gets you down to 68. And then Ephraim and Manasseh are also listed in that Genesis 46 genealogy, but they didn't go to Egypt. They were born in Egypt, born to Joseph by his wife Asenath. So that means that gets us down to 66, which reconciles it. Now, I think, and I didn't get these from the commentators. I don't know why the commentators never, half the time, don't talk about what I want them to talk about. But here's the problem here in verse 26. A different way you can read it. I shouldn't say it's a problem. Let's read verse 26. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt were 66. Now, if you read it that way, with no commas, no parentheses around who came to Egypt, just read it. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, all those people who came, the subject being the people who came, are 66. That would be the 70 in the genealogy, and you knock out Ur and Onan dead, Ephraim and Manasseh already born in Egypt, and that works just perfectly. Then you go down to verse 27, and you read it this way. All the persons of the house of Jacob, parentheses, who came to Egypt, in other words, Jacob, the guy who came to Egypt, were 70. So it's all the persons that are in the genealogy, all the persons in the genealogy of Jacob, who incidentally came to Egypt. It's Jacob who went to Egypt, not the persons who went to Egypt were 70, because 70 persons didn't go to Egypt. There were only 66. That's how you reconcile it, in my humble opinion. Now, there's another way. Ellicott uses this way, and other commentators too. They say you take 70, you subtract Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, because they were already down there in Egypt, and then you take Jacob out because he's the head of the clan. Well, that's nice, but I can't get it to work. I can't get verse 26 and verse 27 to rewrite doing it that way. I'm not going to go into my troubles with that. I'm just going to say I don't believe that. I believe the easiest way is just to subtract Ur and Onan because they were dead, Ephraim and Manasseh because they were born in Egypt, and 70 minus 4 is 66, and there you have it. Now, there's another problem here because Stephen in Acts chapter 7, when he's before the lynch mob that killed him, he's reciting the history of Israel, trying to witness to those bloodthirsty Jewish leaders. And he quotes this, well, he mentions this genealogy here, and he mentions this in Acts 7:14. In the midst of his rehash of the story, Stephen says this, "Then Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all." Oh, my gosh, now we got another number, 75. Well, actually, that's not all that hard, because Stephen was using the Septuagint text. And the Septuagint text, and I don't know why they did this, they added five people. At Genesis 46:20, right in the middle of that genealogy that I just read, in the middle of the Genesis 46 genealogy, the Septuagint added a son of Manasseh, two sons of Ephraim, and one grandson of Manasseh, and one grandson of Ephraim, and that's five extra people. And so Stephen is quoting the Septuagint. I don't know why the Septuagint did that. I don't know how they have the right to do that. That's over my head. I'm not a PhD in the Old Testament, but that's where that little discrepancy came from. Basically, it's a textual problem. We go now to Genesis 46, 28, and 29. Now, he, that's Jacob, sent Judah before him, before Jacob, to Joseph. You got three J's there, Jacob, Judah, and Joseph, to point out the way before him, before Jacob, to Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel, his father Jacob. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. Now we notice once again that Judah is the spokesman for the brothers. He was the one that, he was the advanced scout that went out from Beersheba to see Joseph. We see Judah being the leader now. Remember, Reuben squandered his leadership by sleeping with Jacob's concubine Bilhah. Simeon and Levi squandered their leadership roles. Reuben was the oldest guy that slept with Bilhah, the oldest son, and he was the one that slept with Bilhah. And then Simeon and Levi were sons number 2 and 3, and they had killed the Shechemites when they were trying to revenge the rape of their sister Dinah by a gentleman named Shechem the Shechemite. And then they said they had that false circumcision ceremony, and while they were all recovering in pain, they went out there and killed them when they were sort of helpless. So Judah was upset about that. Jacob was upset about that. So there's the first three kids gone. Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. Judah was number 4, and he's in charge here. And we see that in the previous stories, in our previous audios. Judah had offered himself as surety to Jacob for Benjamin's return. He said, hey, if I don't bring him back, Jacob, you can take it out on me. When Judah was in Egypt, he was negotiating with Joseph concerning Benjamin. He said, look, if you want to put Benjamin in jail for stealing that silver cup that I found, that we found in his sack, instead of putting Benjamin, make Benjamin a slave, make me a slave. He wanted to be a substitute for his brother Benjamin. So anyway, we see Judah in charge here. Now Judah's still the point man. Judah's tribe later became very prominent in Israel, as the NIV Study Bible points out. This is obvious. Genesis 49, 8 through 10, when Jacob was giving his blessings to the sons, he said, Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff. That's because Messiah is from the line of Judah, the Lion of Judah on the throne. He has a scepter. He rules. The ruler's staff will not depart from his feet until Shiloh come. Shiloh is the Messiah. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. That would be the Messiah. So Judah is a very prominent tribe in Israel. And so we need to point that out every chance we get. Now, this is interesting to me about how Judah is going to point out the way to Goshen. Because if he goes ahead and figures out how to go to Goshen, how is he going to communicate with Jacob on where to go? Well, the answer to this is that Judah went on ahead all the way into Egypt, met Joseph, told Joseph that Jacob was coming, and then he said, Joseph, now where should I take our father Jacob? Where should I put him in Goshen? You got to give me directions. And so Joseph would, of course, prepared a dwelling place for them. And so he told Judah where that dwelling place was. And so then Judah turns around, goes back, and meets Jacob en route on the way to Goshen. Now, this was a smart thing to send Judah on ahead to Joseph because it wouldn't be appropriate for a large company to enter the borders of Egypt without announcement. I don't know what their customs arrangements were back then, but it's probably some spies or some people saying, whoa, is somebody coming to invade us? The word would have gotten out and there might have been a military problem. So Judah went on ahead. Barnes agrees with me when he says that Judah went ahead to get the requisite directions from Joseph. Here's what Barnes says, quote, Barnes says this, Judah went ahead, quote, to get the requisite directions from Joseph and then conduct the immigrants to their destined resting place. Now they were to live in Goshen. Goshen, of course, is that part in the northeastern area of Egypt in the Nile Delta, very fertile, very green. Pharaoh said it was the best land in Egypt. And of course, it's on the border of Israel, the southwest part of Canaan, butted right up against Goshen. So Jacob didn't have to go as far as he might have had to go. Now, Joseph prepared his chariot. Of course, that was probably drawn by horses and not oxen. And it was a big fancy thing because he was a big shot. He went up to Goshen. Up means because Egypt is low and Goshen was higher as you climb on up to Canaan. Canaan's even higher. So he's going up to Goshen. And then he falls on Jacob's neck. It says he fell on his neck. It's not sure whether Joseph fell on Jacob's neck or whether Jacob fell on Joseph's neck. We don't know who that he refers to. It doesn't matter. They were both crying like babies. They hadn't seen each other in over 22 years. We go now to verses 31. We go down to verse 30. Then Israel, that's Jacob, said to Joseph, now let me die since I have seen your face that you are still alive. Well, actually, Jacob didn't die. He lived 17 years after this. So we read in Genesis 47, 28, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. So he was 130 when he left Hebron to go to Egypt, and he lived there in Egypt until he died at the age of 147. Now we go to Genesis 46, verses 31 through 34, and we'll finish this audio. Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, my brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? You shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. Now, Pharaoh would probably call the leaders of this band of Hebrews coming into the country, probably saying, what you doing? Why are you here? What's your occupation? You know, just to make sure they're not spies and such. And they tell the truth, they're livestock. Now, why did Joseph want them to tell Pharaoh that they were shepherds? Well, because shepherds were loathsome to the Egyptians, as the scripture here says in verse 34, they're loathsome, and that means that Pharaoh would not want these loathsome shepherds to come into Egypt. Now, again, we don't know who the Pharaoh is and where the capital was at this time, but assuming it's south of the Delta, somewhere in there, Goshen is to the northeast in the Delta country as it's heading toward Israel, and so the shepherds would then be kept distinct, separate from the average Egyptian, and especially the Egyptian court, which would not put up with this. Now, Joseph was not ashamed for his brothers to tell the Pharaoh what their occupation was, but they had to tell him. And Joseph had arranged with the Pharaoh to put them up there in Goshen so they would be separate, and I'm sure the Pharaoh says, fine, if they're shepherds, let's let them live up there. And the Pharaoh might not have been prejudiced against the shepherds. It might have been the people of Egypt and Pharaoh just putting up with the local prejudices. I don't know, but at any rate, Joseph wanted them separate. And why? As John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown suggest, because Jacob and the sons might be corrupted by Egyptian idolatry. I mean, those brothers were pretty corrupt already, except they've repented a little bit. But, you know, I can see how they would be seduced by Egyptian idolatry. At any rate, Joseph's plan worked, as Adam Clark says, because the Hebrew lives and religion were preserved. They were still together when they went on the Exodus. Now, they were going to live in Goshen, which is appropriate. As I've said earlier, it was a land abounding in good pasture, the best of the land, as the Pharaoh said. Joseph probably lived there. We don't know for certain where he lived, but if he was at On, a lot of people think he was at On, which is Heliopolis, which is now a suburb of Cairo, which is right south of where the Delta begins. If you're going from the Mediterranean Sea from north to south, the Delta is all there with those branches of the Nile. When all the branches come down into a common stem, right south of there is modern-day Cairo, but back then it was On, Heliopolis, which the Greeks called Heliopolis. So if Joseph lived there, that's just a speculation. If he lived there, then he's not very far from Goshen, because Goshen is just a little bit to the northeast. I think I saw a YouTube video on the internet where people are speculating from some archaeology they found in Goshen that Joseph might have actually lived up in Goshen. But at any rate, interesting stuff, but I am not competent to go over all that stuff. But I would urge you to get on YouTube and look at some of this stuff. It really is interesting, archaeology and the Old Testament and so forth. Now, why were shepherds loathsome to the Egyptians? Some people think it's because of the Hyksos. That was an earlier view. I think that it's not held today that the Hyksos were shepherds. In fact, the more I read about the Hyksos, the more I think that modern people don't know any more about who the shepherds were than 19th century commentators like Gill and Clark knew. I don't think anybody knows who the Hyksos were. We know they were there, but who they were they shepherds? I don't know. But that's one theory as to why shepherds were loathsome. Another theory is because shepherds tended to be lawless, freebooting bandits. Well, okay. Another theory that Adam Clark mentions is the Israelites sacrificed animals like oxen, sheep, and the Egyptians held those animals sacred as gods. And here these barbaric Hebrews are eating their gods, oxen, sheep. But John Gill questions that oxen, sheep were worshipped by the Egyptians at that earlier time, although they were in later times. So that's up in the air. So I don't know. Nobody knows really why the Egyptians didn't like shepherds, but they didn't. And Joseph fixed that problem by separating the Israelites up there in the land of Goshen. So, we have now finished chapter 46 of Genesis, verses 1 through 34. That leaves us ready to start in our next audio, Genesis 47, 1 through 31. Jacob's family settles in Goshen. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.